You gotta wait until that particular installation is there. Ham radio operators have a little bit like that. When we get on the air and call CQ, just transmitting signals that cover a particular chunk of real estate. If you're on the 20-meter band, you might be covering one quarter of the world, of the surface of the earth, but you know what I mean, when the ionosphere is in really good shape. So you haven't got the vaguest idea where you're going to get an answer from. It's like fishing, and you don't know what kind of fish you're going to pull up. Let me drop it. So we amateurs like the idea of the blunderbuss approach. You're sending RF energy across a substantial percentage of the Earth's surface on HF frequencies on a good ionospheric day, and you can get an answer from any one of those areas. And even with QRP, where you're running 5 watts, as Rich does, K2UPS, there are times when he makes some very long QSOs at 5 watts with a solid-state equipment running on D-cell batteries, if you know what I mean. Yes, you could use a heck of a lot less power if the cable between you and the guy you want to talk to is a fiber optic cable. But installing that cable, somebody's got to pay for it. Somebody's got to pay for the use of it. So that tends to fall pretty much outside of normal ham radio. Now, will a ham radio operator use fiber optic cables between the computers in his house and his ham radio equipment, which is being remotely controlled? He's operating from the first room of the house, and the equipment is in the top of the house, and fiber optic command cabling. And can there be fiber optic cable coupling the signal that goes up the tower to the antenna? Well, you tend not to put high power through fiber optic cables. Let me drop it. In the case of my 10 gigahertz operations, which I haven't done for a few years, and I want to get back to it, the actual transmitter, which is running a fraction of a watt, was in an insulated box behind the 2-foot diameter dish at the top of the 100-foot tower. I didn't want to run transmission line at 10 gigs up the tower because it would get a zillion dB of loss. Waveguide would give 4.5 dB of loss, and waveguide running up a 100-foot tower, that's a substantial installation. Coax cable would give many times higher loss. So you tend to send, in my case, the signal went up the tower on a coax cable on 2 meters. The electronics in the box behind the dish converted 2 meters as a transverter up to 10 gigahertz, and that's what got transmitted. So I was sending signals up and down the tower, B-plus cables to run the transmitter up top, and a coax cable to bring the 2-meter signal up and back down. That could have been fiber optic for the signal, but certain advantages and disadvantages of that. So for the time being, it's my belief that fiber optics is going to be rather lightly used for ham radio operations. It's a little bit too different in philosophy, and for the time being, the fiber optic cables that I know about cannot tolerate, let me pick a number, 100 watts. Let me drop. If I could put a very tiny diameter, 16th of an inch diameter fiber optic cable up the tower, and if I could put 100 watts of RF energy through that fiber optic cable, maybe I'm operating the fiber optic cable at an optical frequency, but I'm modulating it at an RF frequency. That's possible. But the catch is, fiber optic cables run in the milliwatt region. I wouldn't be able to send 100 watts up the tower by that means with the fiber optic cables I know about so far. Now, maybe there's going to be a breakthrough in fiber optic cables by which 100 watts of power to 100 foot of cable will be capable, in which case, because the fiber optic cables are so light, so reliable, so small in diameter, and don't pick up any lightning and whatever, they've got a certain advantages. When I was using a remotely controlled computer system between my house and a shack I've got in the backyard, that was being connected by a fiber optic cable to control a remote computer in a way that wouldn't pick up lightning, if you know what I mean. So certain kinds of communication, fiber optic does a good job, but to really transmit RF, it doesn't quite fulfill the bill yet. That's my opinion. Let me turn it back to you, John, with a great big delay. Anyone else knows by ways by which ham radio operators can make better use of fiber optics, please give us your call letters right now. KC2WGB with a delay. K2RIW in the TechNet.
NY2H.
There's a man who uses fiber. Hey, Lou.
told me about it, he kind of seemed like he didn't want everybody to know about it. I don't know why, but someone we know is doing just that. He's taking his RF, probably at a very low level, and he's got, I imagine, some kind of transducer, which then modulates it. Whoops, hold on, I see smoke here. Where's that coming from?
A fire, probably.
All right, nice. Yep, hold on. One of my power poles. I just cut off the app. Am I making it, Stu?
You sound good, Lou. A little bit of hiss in the background, but you sound good. Please proceed.
All right, it's obviously a bad crimp because it melted the plastic a little bit. All right. So what he's doing is he's actually, as you said, he's modulating the light with RF, and then he demodulates it at the other end, and he pumps that into an amplifier at the base of his tower. So it is being done.
RAY, recognize, but stand by for a minute. Now, Lou, you would estimate that he's running that fiber optic cable in the milliwatt level. Therefore, it goes from the shack to the base of the tower by fiber. Then the amplifier, the RF amplifier at the base of the tower, sends it up the cable to the antenna on the tower. So, he's doing it because he has the ability to do it. What advantage do you think he's getting with that kind of protocol, that kind of technique, Lou? NY2H, is he just doing it because he has the ability? K2RIW in the TechNet?
That's right, yeah, he has the ability to do it. He's got some equipment available to him, so he's experimenting. And yes, I'm sure he's doing it at the very low power levels that laser fiber optics runs at. I don't think that has been beefed up at all. But apparently this technique is used, so it's basically taking RF and modulating the laser light with the RF.
Okay, thank you for that information, Lou. And Joe, W8RYY, wonder if you've used fiber and what's your experience with it. W8RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, I haven't, but what I was going to say is that's been used commercially for about 20-25 years, as far as I know of. It's used quite extensively by cellular companies that are able to put cell site coverage inside places like different malls, like Roosevelt Mall, Minnesotani has it, Smithtown Mall, and Lake Grove, they have it there. That's how you can walk around the entire mall and have, like, uniformity as far as cellular coverage inside the building, because it's actually being rebroadcast around the building using a combination of RF to fiber converters and then back to RF.
Yeah, I used to use words called irrigating a building. You've got a multi-story building, or you've got a great big shopping center that occupies many acres. And as people walk around with their cell phones inside of this metallic structure, you'd like them to have continuous coverage. So by having a whole lot of micro cell sites, a whole lot of individual transmitting antennas scattered throughout the building so that you're irrigating the building with RF, is the words that I used to use, there because you're so close to the transmitting antenna. I mean, if there's enough of them installed in the shopping center, you know, every 500 feet, so to speak, you're never more than 250 feet from an antenna. Therefore, milliwatts or even microwatts coming out of the antenna would be more than enough to keep your cell phone happy. And now sending all those signals by fiber optic, RF modulation of the fiber signal, and then at each antenna, converting the fiber optical RF modulated signal back into pure RF to go to the antenna. That's a nice way of wiring the building. So now you've got a whole lot of fiber cables running around the building as opposed to a whole bunch of coax cables with a whole lot of insertion loss at 2 gig and 3 gig and 5 gig frequencies. So I can see how that's a great way of doing things. And then the local power supplies at each one of these antennas is doing that conversion of the optical signal back to RF. I'm guessing there's a wall wart at each one of those antennas. Is that approximately what the, what you've seen, Joe? W-H-Y-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W with a bunch of guesses.
I haven't had direct connection to that, but I know the company that did it is called SpectraSite. They may have changed names in a couple of years, a couple of years ago, but that was the name, company that did it. And that's exactly what they did. They have low power transmitters, about maybe 10 milliwatts or so of output power, scattered like you said, 400 or 500 feet away, maybe 300 feet between modules, and it'll give you uniformity. You can walk around the building and see like a minus 60 dBm in your cell phone just about everywhere you go. You just never had a hole anywhere you went if they desired that kind of uniformity. But it's very low power going out, but it's a very expensive system. It'll take that stuff, convert it to RF, and then back again. Not something for too many amateurs unless they got deep pockets.
But an awful lot of this technology, like our modern day computers, I mean, the computer that's inside of your cell phone these days is many orders of magnitude more powerful than the zillion-dollar computer that was on the Apollo 11 that landed Neil Armstrong on the moon. So we've come a long way. So these techniques that right now are expensive, with the economy of scale and mass production at some later time, they're going to become cheaper. So hams will be making more use of it for local communication, in other words, between the shack and the tower. But from ham to ham by fiber, I think in general that's going to be rare. Because imagine having some kind of a fiber network in which you get on the air and you're saying, hello CQ, I'm 550 nanometers, this is K2RIW, carefully tuning the band. Somehow I don't see that happening. Maybe you do, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Comment? KC2WGB. Well, Dick, what do you think about the audio being said? Because you look at some of these guys with towers, they have a great length of wire from the shack to the tower. So maybe they could run fiber optic and run the audio only and feed that into their PA system that may be mounted at the top of the tower and no cable loss. What do you think of that as an advantage? Back to you, KC2WGB.
Comment?
Okay, we'll pick up comment in a second. You said the PA system, public address system. Now, not many...
No, power amplifier.
Okay, so the power amplifier is on the top of the tower, and the audio going to it, to the real transceiver. That's not a bad technique. Yep, as long as the power to run your transceiver is already there at the top of the tower. That in itself represents a little bit of a problem. Putting 110 or 220 volt power, or very high current, 13 volt power up a tower, represents a little bit of a challenge. Person who said comment, please give us your full set of call letters, then your name, and then your comment, sir. K2IW in the TechNet.
This is K1MJM, mic number 2. Just a comment on fiber optic cable. I'm not sure if I'm coming through okay. Just a comment on fiber optic cable. When they use it for things like welding, for transferring welding power from a laser welder to the other end of the cable, they're running 100 meters of cable. The cable, fiber optic cable, is a couple thousandths of an inch in diameter, and they're running thousands of watts through it. I don't know how you would convert that to RF, but they're running thousands of watts through a couple thousandths inch diameter cable.
Okay, K1MJM, Mike, number 2. K2RIW. We call him Mike number 2 because his website, LimeOnTechNet.com, gives you a lot of additional information about the TechNet. Mike number 1 is AmateurRadio.TangoVictor, in which you can listen to all the past recordings of the TechNet with about a week delay. So that many watts sending through hundreds of feet of fiber cable, interesting. However, I suspect that that kind of cable and the hardware generating hundreds of watts of fiber, of optical, infrared, ultraviolet, whatever it is, that can do welding. welding or cutting. I'm guessing that currently is fairly expensive hardware. Is that true, Mike? K1MJM, KQRIW in the TechNet.
No, they're actually diode arrays. The prices are coming way down. 2,500 watts is not uncommon these days. Companies like Trump, that's T-R-U-M-P-F, Trump, is one of the companies that makes the equipment. And they're probably talking in the, you know, tens of thousands of dollars for a 2,500 watt unit. And there's a lot of stuff going on in there. They distribute it. There's switches where they can distribute it to multiple workstations. So it's not just strictly laser going through there. There's a lot of other things going on. But it's a diode array. Back over to you, Dick, K1MJM.
That's a bit amazing to me, Mike. Now, the cable that's taking 2,500 watts of fiber optical power, is that cable larger in diameter, the fiber optic cable larger in diameter than the fiber optic that is transmitting telephone and television signals down the fiber to the curb in my cable TV system done by BIOS, for instance? Is that a larger diameter fiber, do you believe, Mike? K1MJM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, Dick, I believe it's the same diameter or possibly a little bit smaller, and out of 100 meters, they get less than 1 watt of loss in 100 meters, less than 1 watt of loss.
Less than 1 watt of loss when running at 2,500 watts. Wow. That's a dB per 100 feet number that's, you know, extremely small. You know, we're talking about 0.001 dB here. Wow. Now, the company doing this, it sounded like Trump, T-R-U-M-P, but I know it's not. So tell us the name of that company, Mike, where we could Google that word and read about this. Fascinating stuff. K1MJM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I think you had the name right. It's Trump with a foxtrot on the end. T-R-U-M-P, foxtrot on the end there.
Okay. Tango Radio, Uniform, Mike, Papa Foxtrot, Trump. Out of curiosity, Mike, where are they located? And I think you're saying that these high-powered diodes, these optical diodes putting out kilowatts of power, are only in the tens of thousands of dollars. In other words, a very small number of very rich ham radio operators can consider this. So Trump is located where, Mike? K1MJM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is K1MJM. I believe they're based in Germany, but the facility I'm familiar with is in Hartford. It's right near Bradley Airport. There's also a company that I deal with called Joining Technologies. That's Joining Technologies. They use those Trump lasers. They're in the same neighborhood, and they have quite a few of those lasers in their facility. And they have an interesting website, too, if you want to find out more about laser welding.
Fantastic. What is the advantage of using optical laser welding as opposed to more conventional welding? Is it because the surface doesn't get oxidized and it's a better way of welding aluminum? What's the advantage that's driving this technology, Mike? K1MJM, K2RIW.
Roger, it's a very focused beam. The two higher quality, higher precision beams are electron beam welding and laser welding. And that company, Joining Technologies, I mentioned, they do both. So again, their website would be an interesting place to visit. They have a lot of videos. It's a very precise beam. They can split the beam, so they can do multiple welds with one beam at the same time to eliminate distortion. So if you want to weld something light and thin, you can hit two spots at the same time with the same beam by doing beam splitting. So there's a lot of advantages.
Fantastic. Unusual. Hey, John, I bet you and I never expected to get an answer like this one. Wow. These guys have hit onto something, John. KC2WJB. I'm shaking my boots a little bit, worried about what the next question's going to be. go ahead, John.
Comment.
Okay, somebody else has comment. Who are you? Give us your call letters, name, and then your comment, sir. K2LIW.
This is WL2PJF. All you heard is correct. It's the latest technology and most advanced method of this particular technology. So that's the way to go. Every day, as you know, we have improvements, and this is the latest way to go. I've been reading about this. WA2PJF, Vito standing by.
Vito, what magazine were you reading when you read about this? Looks like you're out in front of ahead of us. You're ahead of the rest of us, Vito. What were you reading when you read about this?
As you know, I'm always constantly inquisitive as the latest whatevers. We have vendors in Home Depot that come up with information who direct me to various different websites. There are different websites, Google this information, and you will find that a lot of technology comes up. It's not a magazine per se. It's Googling this and word of mouth. And we have at the store many customers, electrical engineers, scientists, and people who are very, very educated who come in. And I usually make it a point to strike a conversation with these people, noting in reference, let me drop. Noting in reference to the language, the way they speak, their mannerisms, and so forth, you can tell within a few seconds if the person is educated or not, or is talking nonsense or not. We have people come in there that claim they're electricians. Within about 30 seconds, I can tell if they're electricians or not. So I pick up on all of this, and the gentleman who was speaking about this is very, very correct in what he has to say, and all of he had to tell you. So follow what he had to say, and also, it's also online in various different avenues of information. So I do agree. With all due respect, I'm sorry to butt in. We had a telephone company, we had Budinsky's special telephones. We used to butt into conversations. So I'm Budinsky's. WA2PJF is standing by.
And stop apologizing, Alvito. We're glad to hear what you know about this. Now, I am curious, because you are in tight with Home Depot, and you're one of the guys that studies all of their manuals, all of their educational movies, and so on. Is there fiber optic hardware, fiber optic machinery being sold at Walmart at this time? Can I walk into Walmart and buy any kind of fiber optic components that you know of at this time? You're not advertising, don't worry. I mean, you're not making any money off of this. I'm asking you a technical question. WA2PJF, K2LIW, the TechNet.
Okay, to be very, very, very correct and right to the point, I have no information about this. I am not going to volunteer or guess that there's something available. I'm going by what the vendors, the sellers, the people who have their product online and in our stores have to offer, and what I see online as well. So, I don't have an answer to that question, okay? I really do not know that answer. But, however, it's up to the individual, the buyer beware, and see what's out there. But no, I have no direct answer to that question at this point. Go ahead.
Okay, there's an honest man who knows what he doesn't know. I was in Home Depot a couple of months ago. I was amazed about the number of things that I could buy that I used to buy in Radio Shack. USB cables and video cables, RF amplifiers and RF converters and so on. And I bought some of those things. So as I said, a number of the things I used to buy in Radio Shack I can now buy at Home Depot. So they're coming along very nicely. So, this fiber optics, there's more to it than first meets the eye. Put me somewhere, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW, the TechNet. Boy, these guys are surprising us.
KC2WGB. Oh, you're right. They're full of surprises. By the way, through the plugs that prevents the oxygen in the air from contaminating the weld. So that's how they do that. But all right, I'm going to drop and I'll go on to the next one. Okay, got a young man here who has a question about sound pressure measurements. And his question is, if you know the originating sound power level, and you're, say, a quarter of a mile away, and you measure the dynes per centimeter, whatever the pressure level unit you want to use at that point, could you determine the distance reliably? Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
That's a good one. It's not my area of experience. Almost anything that sends out a signal, radio, light, and probably sound, almost everything, when you're transmitting the signal omnidirectional, in all directions at once, or even if you're directing it with a horn, that can be an acoustic horn as well as a microwave horn, still the signal almost always falls off by the inverse square law. Double the distance, you get one quarter of the amount of power. So if this was a very high altitude emitter of sound, that would be a fairly free space technique, and I'm pretty sure it would fall off by the inverse square law, and you could determine distance. The catch is, you're now talking about the acoustic equivalent of what we RF engineers call ground waves. Let me drop. If my emitter of the sound, just like my emitter of a radio wave, is some small number of feet off the ground, 5 feet or 50 feet off the ground, and I'm now talking to somebody, let me pick a number, 50 miles away, where I've got a lot of trees, buildings, water towers, all kinds of obstructions in between, earth curvature, all kinds of things are going on. The signal falls off a lot faster, radio-wise, a lot faster than inverse square law. That's part of the reason why you and I, with two handy talkies on 2 meters, we're talking to each other and one of us is walking away from the other. By the time we get a mile or two apart, the signal is getting pretty marginal when we're walking across the surface of the earth, going through normal neighborhoods and woods and whatever. Whereas that exact same handy talkie, when it's mounted on the space shuttle, and Owen Garriott is using an antenna taped to the window of the space shuttle, and he's over northern Texas, 1,570 miles away from me, and he transmits 5 watts with that handy talkie, and I'm hearing him 10 dB out of the noise, 15 dB out of the noise, with the whip antenna on top of my car at the parking lot at AIO in Deer Park, and that took place back in 1985. Let me drop. So if somebody asks you, what is the range of a handy talkie? Handy talkie to handy talkie on the earth, maybe it's 1 or 2 miles, reliable. Put one of those handy talkies, the guy up on a mountain, much greater distance. Put one of those handy talkies on a guy on the space shuttle at 180 miles altitude, and 1,500 miles is easy. So measuring distance when you've got earth curvature is a big factor. So I am guessing that audio is going to follow the same characteristic. So I'm guessing the audio is going to fall off a lot faster than inverse square law when the emitter is close to the earth by comparison to the range. That's a bunch of guesses. I'm sure there are ways of Googling just the right words and finding better data on this exact subject. We usually have a lot of brain power in the tri-state area of New York City, which is where this repeater is located, also covered by internet and IRLP and whatever. There's a lot of brain power, in theory, all connected right now. Somebody out there might have a much better answer. So if something is emitting a sound and I'm X number of miles away, by the amplitude of what I measure, if I know the strength of the source, can I determine range from that easily? Anybody got some further data? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KTUPS Mobile.
Okay. Hey, Rich. What have you done along these lines? My guess is the horn, which is a real loud horn you've got on that over the road truck driving in right now. I bet you that horn can be heard a good number of miles on a good day. KTUPS, mobile, probably entering Pennsylvania. K2IW, the TechNet. You got it, Rich.
KTUPS, mobile. Good evening again, Dick. Yeah, the horn's pretty loud on here. We're trying not to blow because it wakes the guy up who's sleeping in the back. The only current application, or at least one of the current applications I know of that uses a method to measure sound and pinpoint something is used by many police departments. Matter of fact, even right on Long Island, I know in several different communities, I think Huntington is one, Arlington Station, Freeport might be another, or Hempstead. They have monitors set up on telephone poles to listen for gunshots and can very quickly determine the bearing of that gunshot in relative to the sensor, and I think as well as distance, so that police can then respond to the site of the shooting very quickly. I don't know if anybody has heard of that system. I can't think of the name of it offhand, but I remember reading about it in the paper back then.
Shot spotter. Now, what was the name of that again? The prisoner just gave us the name.
SOAPG, it's called Shot Spotter.
Very fine, Dave. So Dave tells us it's called Shot Spotter. I know they've got that system installed in Brentwood, Huntington, and Rich just gave us a few other towns. So a number of detectors, acoustic detectors, probably mounted on a significant number of utility poles, all detect the fact that a firearm was discharged, and by the timing, because sound moves at something like a foot per millisecond, by the timing of the individual signal, in other words, two different utility poles that might be in line, one's going to pick up the sound quite a number of milliseconds sooner than the other. Radio-wise or electronically, the signal is being transmitted in nanoseconds through the wiring, and so therefore the difference in the timing back to the central analysis station tells you a direction of arrival and probably range. And I believe that these gunshot detecting systems can quite often locate where the gunshot took place, quite often to the nearest residence, is my understanding. So acoustically over a short number of miles within a community, that is being done. So it's both ranging and direction finding in order to do locating. There's the whole art and science to taking signals of different timing and different signal strength and giving you the best elliptical area of probability, as it's called. It's really a locating algorithm. So anybody with any further information on that system, give us a call, let us right now. K2IW and TechNet. I believe, by the way, that's quite successful.
KD2IXP.
KD2IXP. K2RIW. Go right ahead, sir.
Dick, there's a lot of things to be considered to do a very accurate monitoring. The altitude, the air pressure, the humidity, the terrain, what makes up the terrain, whether it's metal buildings, brick buildings, wood buildings, all of that is figured into the algorithms. And to do it accurately requires a very extensive algorithm.
John, it sounds like you have worked with people that are familiar with this system. And so am I close to right when I'm saying that in the communities where this system has been installed, quite often they're able to locate the gunfire frequently approximately to the nearest house under good conditions? Is that true, John? KD2IXP, K2RIW?
If the variables of the algorithm are complete, you can judge the distance to within 20 meters.
Fantastic. By my standards, to the nearest 20 meters, roughly 61 or 62 feet, that really locates it to the nearest residence. Okay. So, people are firing off firearms, and you think that you're doing it anonymously. Maybe not so. So, do you have a guess, John, as to what the person asking the question is trying to do? In the case of pyrotechnics, in the case of bombs going off, there have been studies where you put acoustic detectors on high-flying balloons, and in theory you can tell where a bomb went off. When it comes to acoustic detecting through the earth, it's essentially acoustic, although it's really seismic, I would call it. Somebody does an underground nuclear bomb explosion, the detectors that the United States has, among other countries, is able to rather accurately locate where that bomb went off. So acoustics through the earth, nowhere near quite as accurate as what we just talked about. Let me drop it. But locating an atomic bomb or an earthquake, locating an earthquake, I think those systems are working rather well. But acoustic detection through air, ranging for, let's say, miles, it's quite difficult unless you've got a rather large array. So the electronic steering capability of a radio phased array antenna, where you can electronically aim the antenna for either transmission or reception purposes, and therefore get some very good angle of arrival information. Acoustic arrays have been set up underwater, which work very well. Literally keep track of, it could be a large number of miles away where somebody launches a submarine, and by your acoustic array you've got on the west coast of the United States, you know quite a bit about where that submarine is located. So acoustic detecting with a phased array system underwater has a lot of history and a fair amount of success. So I would therefore speculate, if you're willing to put up an acoustic array of detectors in air, I think you can get a lot of information about angle of arrival and range, distance. That's my guess. But you got to add a lot of variables in there as to what terrain was in that direction. Was that direction a bunch of woods, a bunch of buildings, or an open field? And that's going to change the answer by a whole lot, I think. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNav.
KC2WGB. I have no reason, I have no understanding of why he's asking the question. Interesting question. But, you know, also we have wind to worry about, and like John said, pressure level changes, a lot of things. But he was speaking about one receiver, knowing the original power level, and by measuring the receive level, determine the distance. I think with a single, that may be an issue, might be a problem. But I think it was a good question. But let me let it drop on. What's up next?
Comment.
Go ahead, comment. Is that you, John?
Yes, that's IXP. Depending upon what you're measuring through, even the ground, there's a device that the military has been using for a number of years called PSID, a personal seismic intrusion detector, that can determine where a footfall is and how heavy the person is, or if the person is carrying something, just by their walking on the ground. Knowing, again, what all the variables are in the algorithm, knowing what the ground is made of, knowing the moisture level of the ground. Is it rocks? Is it dirt? Is it sand? It's all taken into account. Some people have spent very many years, you know, working out the algorithm, and it's actually quite accurate.
Fantastic. And Airborne Instruments Laboratory during the Vietnam War was manufacturing a Ku-band man-pack radar called the PIPS-5, PPS-5 radar, which with 0 to 3 kilometers of range, when this thing, the antenna was waving back and forth and detecting things that moved, it was a Doppler radar. And so within 3 miles, if it detected something that moved out there in the woods around you, so to speak, by the sound that was made, you could tell range and object. You have very different kinds of Doppler shift radar echo from, say, for instance, a tracked vehicle versus a vehicle with six wheels and so on. Very different characteristic sound. Even a man walking or a female walking makes different characteristic Doppler sounds as various portions of the body move in a certain way. So when it comes to detecting moving things, seismic detection of something walking on the ground, or radio detection, KU band radar detection of things walking in the woods, there are some fancy detectors out there. KC2WGB, K2RAW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB, very good, Dick. Let me go on to this next question, which is sort of interesting also. Let me drop. Okay, this gentleman is asking that if a component has a rating not to be exceeded of 5 volts. Now, he's not talking about a DC component, only AC, and he knows that if it's a DC component, that has to be taken into consideration. But his question is, if it's rated for 5 volts, does that mean that's an RMS rating? And could he put approximately 14 volts peak to peak across that and have no failure? What does the rating on components mean when it says 5 volts? Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
I'm doing a calculation right now. Square root of 2 times 5 is 7 volts peak. So a 5 volt signal, 5 volts RMS, is 14.14 volts peak to peak. And therefore, the only way to be sure is hopefully the manufacturer of that component, when he said it can take 5 volts AC. Because whenever someone talks about AC magnitude, in my opinion, 95% of the time they're talking about RMS voltage, a sine wave, which has the same amount of heating value if it went into a pure resistor as a 5 volt DC signal. A so-called 5 volt RMS signal is going to be hitting 7 volts, 7.07 volts positive peak and 7.07 volts negative peak. It's just the way a sine wave with 5 volts of heating value, 5 volts RMS, behaves. So if the manufacturer made it clear that his rating is 5 volts RMS, you've got it made. If the component is just rated for 5 volts, and you're not sure if it's AC or DC, you could be in trouble. So it would be sure nice to say that anybody talking about 5 volts is talking about the same thing. In the case of AC, the 5 volts of AC, you can discuss it from a peak value of 5 volts, an RMS value of 5 volts, an average value of 5 volts, and you get 3 different readings, and a DC value of 5 volts. You get 3 different readings. So RMS, I think, is used a high percentage of the time, but be careful. So I'm not sure there's a...
Repeater, time out.
I'm not sure there's a guarantee on that. I'm going to turn it back to John with some delay in case other people out there have got some more opinions on this one. A 5 volt rating for an AC component. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
WS2N, would they ever consider peak to peak, you know, 14 in that example?
If I'm using some kind of a coupling capacitor as a resonant, I'm using a capacitor as part of a resonant circuit, part of a filter, and the capacitor just happens to have a 5 volt RMS rating, without a doubt, 5 volts RMS with no DC component is going to be hitting 7 and a fraction volts positive, 7 and a fraction volts negative, 14 and a fraction volts peak to peak. All that happens automatically with 5 volts RMS going into a AC rated capacitor as part of a filter. And if you put any DC voltage simultaneously on that capacitor, if I put 5 volts positive DC at the same time I'm putting 5 volts of RMS, and in one direction, the peak voltage is going to be 7 and a fraction plus 5. It's going to be 12 and a fraction volts in one direction and 3 and a fraction volts in the other direction. So, ratings of components, you got to be careful, as I see it. When it comes to AC ratings, I think it's almost always RMS, but every so often there's going to be a manufacturer who thinks in some other way. So I think you got to be careful. KC2WGB with some delay. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. I agree with you, Dick. I think when it comes to failure, they usually use the RMS component, but it, like you say, there's no guarantee. And that's a mysterious rating. Usually it states what that is. But, okay, I guess he's playing with this stuff and just wanted to know without damaging the components. Be interesting. Let's hope it's the RMS values. All right, let me let it drop, and I have one more I'm going to try to explain to you. This is a good one.
Yeah, before we leave this one, there's one other component we didn't, characteristic we didn't mention. Let me jump. If, for instance, it is a capacitor rated for 5 volts RMS, that rating only has meaning across a certain frequency region if that capacitor is being used as an audio filter network. Then maybe that capacitor can tolerate 5 volts RMS at any frequency up to and including 15 kilohertz or 20 kilohertz. You put 5 volts RMS across that capacitor, and you do it at 5 megahertz, you're going to get something very, very different. Because as you go up in frequency, the capacitor reactance goes down. You know, 1 over 2 pi, 2 pi square root of LC, that formula. So as you go up in frequency, the capacitor reactance is getting lower. Therefore, the same 5 volts you're putting on the capacitor at higher frequencies is getting to higher and higher currents flowing into the capacitor. Greater and greater amounts of dielectric heating. Every dielectric material has a certain loss tangent. Let me drop. Every dielectric material you put inside of a capacitor generates a certain amount of heat as a function of what frequency and what amplitude. And as you go to higher in frequencies of the same amplitude, you're going to get more and more heat. So that 5-volt rating capacitor, guarantee, in most cases, I can choose a frequency high enough where even though I don't exceed 5 volts, I will damage that capacitor. So that's another factor you got to worry about. That's if it's a capacitor. If it's a resistor, usually that's not so frequency sensitive. An inductor quite often is frequency sensitive also. You put 5 volts across an inductor, and you do it at a low enough frequency, where the inductive reactance is a small enough number, now you're putting a huge amount of current into the inductor, and you're going to burn it up. So inductors will fail if the frequency is too low, and you're keeping it 5 volts. Capacitors will fail if the frequency is too high, and you're keeping it 5 volts. Resistors are kind of neutral on that one. So there's more of a minefield here than first meets the eye. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
K2WGB, it never fails to amaze me. Some of the things that are so simple come up as a question, and look what it leads to. And you're absolutely right. I've had capacitors that would work normally until the frequency went too high, and they perforated for that exact same reason. So, yeah, got to be careful. All right, now, I have one more, but it might be a lengthy one, Dick. You want to save that for next week, or you want to give it a shot? It's up to you.
I want to give it a shot, but I'm going to give you one other example. I personally designed a capacitor which could tolerate, let me think of the number, probably 10,000 volts. 10,000 volts was flowing across this capacitor at 432 megahertz, where the total current into the capacitor was probably greater than 10 amperes. So can you imagine designing a capacitor that can take 10 amperes at 30,000 volts at the 432 megacycles?
Is that oil filled?
Not a chance. Nothing on planet Earth can tolerate that as a dielectric except air. capacitor on the end of the tuned line, the actual resonator on the 432 parallel kilowatt amplifier. April issue, QST Magazine, 1972. You look at the April issue, you look at this 5-inch, I think it was 5-inch or 6-inch wide resonator, roughly 8 inches long, with a pair of tubes at one end, and this swapper capacitor at the other end. The capacitor was a sheet of beryllium copper, about 3 inches wide, which gets deflected closer and further away from that printed circuit board, which is the resonator, an air gap in between of about an inch. And so you're, with a piece of fishing string, you're towing on this piece of, you're towing on this piece of beryllium copper that's screwed down to the wall. It's 3 inches wide. And as you pull on it, you're bending it. As you're bending it, you're changing the air gap. The air gap is changing the number of picofarads for this resonator, for this capacitor that's at the end of the resonator to tune the line. That was the tuning control. That tuning control was tolerating 30 kilovolts. Rough number, 30 kilovolts, 10 amperes, 432 megacycles. That's a capacitor. You build that capacitor with some kind of a tuning screw where that current is flowing through the threads and you're going to be welding it. But simply bending a piece of beryllium copper and pulling on it with a piece of Dacron fishing string made a very inexpensive, very high performance capacitor. That's a capacitor. KC2WGB, K2LIW, the TechNet.
Well, Dick, I'm surprised you didn't use like a Teflon screw for an adjustment, but fishing line will work, absolutely. But seems a little weird. All right, let me drop.
In that environment, that amount of RF energy would create heating of the Teflon. It might survive, it might not. A Teflon screw, yeah, that would survive. I was thinking of a nylon screw. A nylon screw would melt in that environment. But a piece of fishing string towed on this flapper capacitor, the string went through a small hole in the base of this flat chassis, and a rod below the chassis winding up the string came to a knob at the front panel. As you turn the knob at the front panel, you're winding up the string, which is pulling on this piece of beryllium copper that's being bent, and that changed the capacitance. That was the tuning control. Very high performance tuning control. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
Okay, I see the way you're making that adjustment. That would work fine. The problem is now, the resilient return of the copper, beryllium copper, as you wound it up on the shaft, the monofilament, it would pull it or separate it. Then when you release that line, you set it back, did it have the ability to return to the original position, by the way?
Yeah, the sheet of copper was, make believe it was a 3-inch square of beryllium copper. And one end of that 3-inch square was really bent down at a right angle and screwed to the chassis, screwed to the vertical wall of the chassis. This horizontal piece of beryllium copper, if you wound up the string real tight, the beryllium copper would bend all the way down and touch the lower wall of the chassis, the lower bottom plate of the chassis. If you release the string all the way, it would bend up only to, almost to the point where it would touch the resonator. And because the resonator had plate voltage on it, 2,000 volts, I sometimes put a sheet of Teflon there to make sure I wouldn't be shorting things out. But most of the time, it operated with close to an inch of air spacing when this thing is being used. And beryllium copper, a 3-inch square of it, is so bendy when you're pulling on the end of it. To bend it down at, let me pick a number, 25 or 30 degree angle, we'll let go of it, it goes up straight, has no trouble experiencing that bend and coming back to the original condition. Over to you, John. It wasn't creating a permanent set of that beryllium copper. Very thin sheet of beryllium copper, probably 5 or 10 thou. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Oh, okay, yeah, thin, because you really don't need it to be thick, so that gave you some flexibility. All right, very good. Let me let it drop, and I'll go on to this next question. Okay, here we have a question about waveguide. Oh, right up your alley, Dick. Okay, we have a piece of waveguide, whatever frequency, it doesn't matter. on this waveguide, we have the group propagation going to the right, let's say, and maybe we have six or eight signals traveling through there, different frequencies, different amplitudes, different phase relationships. They cause harmonics. Now, these harmonics develop and create some group delay, as you know. His question is it possible to have a combination of those harmonics with the phase delay traveling to the right, or the phase propagation traveling to the right, and the group delay traveling to the left, or returning to the source? Is that possible? Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB. I hope I formed it correctly for you.
Yeah, I think you did, John. And I think the answer is no. First of all, a signal going down a waveguide. They got all kinds of crazy diagrams of the E field and the H field and the peaks and the valleys and the nulls and whatever in the books. The best way to explain waveguides is it's very similar to your favorite barbershop. You walk through the front door of your barbershop, and most barbershops will have a great big wide mirror on the front wall, a great big wide mirror on the back wall. And so if you look into the barbershop at a 45-degree angle, into those mirrors, the barber that's on the fifth chair down further away from you in that barbershop, you're seeing him many times in a row. That signal is bouncing back and forth between those mirrors on the left wall and the right wall. Waveguide works the same way. If I've got a piece of waveguide laying flat on the table, so that the broad wall is flat on the table and the narrow walls are vertical, that signal goes down the waveguide by zigzagging back and forth. It bounces off the narrow walls, opposite of common sense. Let me drop them. Each and every signal bounces off those vertical walls at an extremely precise angle. If you're operating within the rated frequency region of that waveguide, that angle of bounce is exactly determined to the nearest micro degree. At that frequency, that wavelength, and by the way, the spacing between the left and right vertical wall must be greater than a half wavelength at your frequency. Otherwise, the signal doesn't go down the waveguide at all. So it's more than a half wavelength, and the signal's bouncing back and forth. Higher frequency signals bounce at a more shallow angle. A higher frequency signal goes down the waveguide faster in group delay. And I'm not going to say is it faster or lower in phase delay. Got to be careful on that one. But the group delay, it's bouncing between those walls at a more shallow angle as you go up in frequency. The limiting situation is you go all the way up to an optical frequency. You and I can look down that piece of waveguide with our eye, and we look straight down the guide. The radio signal never does that. Let me drop it. That's a good proof that as you go to higher and higher frequencies, the bounce between the walls becomes more and more shallow, and eventually the angle to the wall goes to 0 degrees when you go to a high enough frequency. And you're way into the multi-mode of the waveguide. Now, a whole lot of optical frequencies go straight down the guide with no problem at all. And, yeah, you'll see some mirrored surfaces if it's nice and shiny. So that's one thing that happens. So if I now put multiple signals down that waveguide, it is definitely dispersive. If it's a broadband signal or if it's multiple signals, the higher frequency component of a broadband signal gets there sooner because it's bouncing at a more shallow angle. Let me drop it. Under normal circumstances, if I'm using thoroughly linear waveguide, by linear I mean I don't have any rusty joints, you know, copper oxide rusty joints with rusty nails, so to speak, or rusty screws. I've got ordinary, well-tuned, clean, shiny waveguide, and I'm putting multiple frequencies on it. The waveguide absolutely, positively does